I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. If you thought this year's presidential election was going to be about how to create jobs and improve the U.S. economy, think again. In recent weeks, President Obama, Governor Romney, their surrogates, and supporters have been lobbing attacks and accusations at each other, and many of them have ended up on TV. Here's an ad that's been described by some as a low blow. It's produced by the pro-Obama super PAC Priorities USA, attacking Romney and Bain Capital.
When Mitt Romney and Bain closed the plant, I lost my health care. And my family lost their health care. And a short time after that, my wife became ill. I don't know how long she was sick. And I think maybe she didn't say anything because she knew that we couldn't afford the insurance. And then one day she became ill, and I took her up to the Jackson County Hospital. And admitted her for pneumonia, and that's when they found the cancer. And by then, it was stage four. There was nothing they could do for her. And she passed away in 22 days. I do not think Mitt Romney realizes what he's done to anyone. Furthermore, I do not think Mitt Romney is concerned.
Priorities USA Action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Here's a new ad by the Romney campaign attacking President Obama on welfare reform. It earned a pants on fire from PolitiFact.
In 1996, President Clinton and a bipartisan Congress helped end welfare as we know it by requiring work for welfare. But on July 12th, President Obama quietly announced a plan to gut welfare reform by dropping work requirements. Under Obama's plan, you wouldn't have to work and wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check. And welfare to work goes back to being plain old welfare. Mitt Romney will restore the work requirement because it works.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message.
Well, here to dissect and discuss the campaign and the state of national politics are Dick Pullman. He's here with us in our Philadelphia studios. He writes a blog called National Interest for WHYY's Newsworks News and Dialogue website. He's also a reporter, blogger for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He did that for 22 years, writes the American Debate column in the paper. And Dick Pullman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And also with us is David Mark, who got up very early, joining us from California, editor-in-chief of Politics, which is published by Topics, and that's the largest local discussion site in the country, formerly a senior editor at Politico. And David Mark, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. And Dick, let me begin with that last ad, because you actually had a piece about it in today's paper. This is the ad that earned pants on fire from PolitiFact, where the Romney campaign essentially attacks President Obama on welfare reform. What did they get wrong, or what did they get right in this ad?
Well, there's basically a credibility chasm between the charge in the ad and the empirical reality of what actually happened with Obama's welfare policy. They were basically saying in the Romney was saying in the ad, and he has since said also on Fox News and on The Stump, that Obama has gutted welfare policy and basically said that you no longer have to work to get welfare benefits, that he's just going to mail people their welfare check.
Not true.
Not true, because what actually happened was is that some governors, including two Republican governors, had petitioned the Department of Health and Human Services to say, hey, give us more flexibility on how we can meet that goal of moving people from welfare to work. We want to try some stuff on our own. And so the HHS, Obama's HHS, basically said in a letter last month, okay, we'll give you more flexibility, but you've got to meet these welfare to work rules. So it's like he was basically doing what Republicans say they always want, which is to have the states have more power and more flexibility. So Romney turned that around and basically said, no, he's gutting the whole thing. He's not gutting it. He's tweaking it in the favor of the states.
And to you, David Mark, the first ad we played from Priorities USA, the man is speaking directly to the camera about the death of his wife. It has been criticized by some. Where do you come down on this particular ad?
It is interesting that this one was run, as was noted, by an outside group, whereas the Mitt Romney welfare ad came directly from the campaign. It seems like a small distinction, but often these outside groups are willing to go much further, and they're willing to take the heat over it. The proprietors of this ad, Priorities USA, they've had their spokesman out on TV defending it, if you want to call it that, to a certain degree. I don't think this is something the Obama campaign would want to touch directly, and it gives them plausible deniability. Absolutely. It's pretty unfair. It's a stretch of the truth. It goes beyond credibility, but that's politics. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to see a lot more of that over the next couple of months.
But it seems the super PACs can do the dirty work for the campaigns. David?
That's right, but there's also the risk of it backfiring. When people see an ad like this that essentially blames the candidate for a cancer death, that's a very serious thing. Anybody who's been touched by cancer, I think, might say, wait a minute. So I'm not sure this actually helps quite as much as we think. I do feel in both of these situations, these ads are a way to kind of gin up the base on either side. For Mitt Romney to tell Republicans, I'm not going soft against President Obama. I'm not going to be a pushover. And for the president's side to say, we're not going to sit down and take it from Mitt Romney. So I think it's almost a message to their own sides as much as independent, undecided voters.
And Dick, there's so much money pouring into these campaigns, whether directly to the candidate, to the parties, to the super PACs, and we've got these nonprofits, which just kind of feeding all they advertise, and I guess a lot of it showing up on television.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always of two minds about this the money story. I don't write about it as much, perhaps, as I should, but what stops me a lot is that I think a lot of people sort of equate big money with effectiveness, that, you know, that just if one side has more money, that means they're going to be more effective, if they're they're going to ratchet up their chances of winning. And I don't necessarily see them, the correlation. I mean, I think George Will, actually, on one of the Sunday shows a few weeks ago, had a good point about Romney. Well, he's been kind of critical about Romney, but he was basically talking about all the super PAC money that's pouring in on behalf of Romney. And he basically said, the money doesn't necessarily matter in advertising. You have to have a good product to sell.
Mm.
And so I'm not necessarily sure that everybody's been saying, okay, there's a real imbalance. Obama's not raising, or Obama people on behalf of Obama are not raising as much money as the Republicans. But meanwhile, you look at the latest polling, and not to jump things that might talk about, Marty, but you look at the latest polling just yesterday, a CNN ORC poll has Obama up by 7 nationally and 11, up by 11 among independents. Fox News has Obama up by 9 and 11 up by independents. And so you could make the argument, if the money is so important and so controlling, then why aren't the polls reflecting that?
And David, you've seen some of those same polls as well. Does that tell you something about either the advertising campaigns, where the campaign is, the actual candidates themselves? Because they have been neck and neck for some time, and now it looks like Obama's pulled ahead, at least temporarily.
I certainly agree with Dick on the money issue. Once you get into the range of $400, $500 million, whatever each side has spent or is going to spend, it kind of becomes the law of diminishing returns. There's only so much effectiveness each new ad is going to bring to the campaign. Voters across the country are going to know these candidates, what they stand for. I think the big money may play a larger role in Senate, House, governor's races, et cetera, but I think it's going to be roughly at the level of parity. Maybe Mitt Romney outraises Barack Obama by $20 or $30 million one quarter, or vice versa, but I don't think it makes that much difference. I think sort of the mindlessness of a lot of these ads that we've just been discussing has a lot to do with the static nature of the race, the fact that President Obama, as was just noted, is up by 7-8 points, sometimes more in some of these polls. Mitt Romney has done little to distinguish himself, to break out and really bring down President Obama, and I think that's the real threat for Mitt Romney's candidacy at this point.
Dick, you've covered a lot of presidential campaigns. Is this one any more or less negative and nasty, as we are wont to say?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to, I guess in terms of the sheer money, I guess you'd have to say yes, if that's, again, the only measure. But it's hard to draw these, it's hard to find a yardstick that sort of applies one to another. I mean, I think almost every single campaign, there are some exceptions, but almost every single campaign we say, oh, God, it's worse than ever, it's worse than ever. And you know, I seem to remember the one that just jumped out at me in my head was 1988, which was George Bush Sr. and Dukakis, where the ads about Willie Horton and these ads of, you know, sort of revolving door furloughs and Boston Harbor being polluted and all this kind of stuff that was run against Dukakis especially was considered, oh, that's the new low. And you know, that might have been worse in one sense, because back then, unlike now, we didn't have these fact-checking organizations. Well, it was pre-internet, too. But we didn't have groups that were saying, let's find out actually whether these claims are true or not. So in that sense, it was worse. You can go back, and there's one of my favorite books, actually, is called The Magnificent Catastrophe. And it's about the election of 1800. And it's all about Jefferson and Adams. And, of course, you know, it's all pamphlets, and they had to be, you know, taken by horseback and everything. But that was the state of play in the media back then. And it was unbelievable. It was like, you know, if Jefferson wins, all the churches are going to close. So,
We've been here before.
Yeah, we've been here before. So I always take heart in historical perspective.
You had to go back 200 years, though, to get it.
But, yeah.
Well, that's okay. David, I wonder, too, and it seems that the response teams now are so quick. Once the candidate or their surrogate say something, then within 24 hours there is a counter argument. And I wonder whether even from the John Kerry campaign, when he was quote unquote swift voted, whether the campaigns just are not going to let a second go by without responding to a criticism.
Right, it's a feeling of it's a fear of unilateral disarmament, that if you let any charge go by, no matter how minor, no matter how seemingly insubstantial, that can get blown up and become a media narrative. And I would say in the news cycle for 24 hours, but in a sense there really is no news cycle anymore. It's just these little things come up like a gust of wind and then they go away. And the feeling is if you let even one go unanswered, you're doing perhaps irreparable damage to your campaign. And I agree with Dick. I don't think that this is a particularly more negative campaign than in the past. What I do think is different is the viral nature of it, the fact that these charges and countercharges now get lobbed on Facebook, on Twitter, on all forms of other social media in ways they get pushed out to people in ways that were unimaginable a quarter century ago, when campaigns basically had to buy 30-second spots on television stations to run at night or whenever. Now you can get these charges out any time of the day, almost in an unlimited supply for little money.
Is that why it's so exhausting, Dick?
Well, it's exhausting for those of us who have to track this stuff. I mean, I think Twitter, I don't know, who was it? Was it Newsweek? Somebody had a story about how people, particularly young people, are getting more sort of psychologically jangled by all the digital media and the 24/7 and the in-the-moment stuff. And, you know, I find myself checking, you know, I feel compulsively I check Twitter, you know.
You can feel it buzzing in your pocket, can't you?
Yeah, or every hour, you know. And so the candidates will respond through, or their spokesman will respond through Twitter. And so it accelerates everything. And, you know, I think we have to remember that there are millions and millions of voters who do not share our, you know, our sort of in the bubble obsession with all this stuff. And I think this is a point I was actually thinking of earlier, was that the debates in October, where, you know, it's free media, basically. You're not paying for that. There's no super PAC ads there. It's just the two candidates and the debates. And so I think that's going to make the difference for a lot of people who are just sort of freezing out all these big money buys.
And that's Dick Pohlman, who joins us along with David Mark. And yes, we are talking about politics. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you frustrated with your child between the ages of 12 and 25 who is using drugs or drinking? Have you argued or pleaded with them to stop? The Family Training Program may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to attend sessions with a family specialist to help you make positive changes in your life and improve your relationship with your child. The Family Training Program is held in Philadelphia and surrounding areas by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or www.iamconcerned.org.
I'm Jordan Morris. The influential punk band Red Cross was started in the late 70s by two brothers, neither of which were even old enough to drive. Their first gig was an opening slot for Black Flag, but the show wasn't in a punk club.
Eighth grade graduation party, so they expected you to play a Foghat cover, and we played Who Are the Mystery Girls?
A New York Dolls cover. Red Cross, this week on Bullseye. From PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
We're on the last lap of the Olympic Games, and America has been strong in the medal count. But back home, there are complaints about how the media is treating some athletes, including gold medalists Serena Williams and Gabby Douglas. Is it fair play or over the line? We'll ask the Barbershop guys to weigh in next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and we're talking election politics, campaign politics. David Mark, joining us from a hotel. You're out in California, right?
That is right, Palo Alto, California.
You got up very early to join us on Radio Times. We appreciate that. He's the brand new editor of Politics, and that's Politix, published by Topics, Topix, and that's a discussion site all over the country, and Politics is a brand new feature for Topics. He's formerly senior editor at Politico. Dick Pullman with us here in our Philadelphia studios, writes the American Debate column for the Philadelphia Inquirer, also has a blog here at WHYY called National Interest, and you can read it on the WHYY Newsworks website. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dick, let me put this to you, because lo and behold, this week it looks like Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich are back. I don't know if they were, you know, frenemies from the 1990s, but had to deal with their own, I guess, disgrace politics. Here they are, back once again. What do you make of that?
Well, in the case of Clinton, I did something. I wrote a column in a paper last Sunday, I guess it was, on this.
Yes, you did.
Or recently, like 100 years ago. But about Obama's decision to make him sort of a very prominent speaker at the convention. I was kind of sad they need each other. I was thinking that, you know, they fought in 2008 with Hillary in the race. But they kind of need each other, because he's got, Clinton's got sort of some mojo with certain kinds of working class white voters and that Obama does not have. Clinton can benefit also from helping Obama. He can collect some IOUs in case Hillary wants to run in 2016. Perhaps he can get Obama's help, if only backstage. So there's some mutual back scratching going on there. And it happens to be that Clinton, as an ex president, I was going to say as an ex president, he's very popular and has like a 65% approval rating, all that. But it's not actually just as an ex president. When he left office, people forget this. Even in the wake of Monica Lewinsky, when he left office, he had approval rating over 60%. So it makes sense for the Democrats to put him out there. And it's interesting that he's going to be front and center, whereas George W. Bush is going to be completely absent, ostensibly by his own choice, from the Republican convention. Now, in terms of Gingrich, I think Gingrich probably has a niche following. And maybe in some ways, a lot of the super PACs can say some things on behalf of Romney that Romney can't say for himself. The irony, of course, with all that, to me, is that who was it who helped open up the Bain Capital issue back in the winter? It was Gingrich. So, that's 6 months ago, and memories are short.
David, you want to weigh in on that? I'm curious about, because I think that the Romney-Gingrich relationship is complicated, to say the least.
Right, I think it's a case of Newt Gingrich needing the spotlight more than Mitt Romney needs Newt Gingrich. Gingrich has been deployed in very specific situations. He was on, a Republican National Committee conference call the other day attacking Barack Obama. But you don't see him out there front and center campaigning with Mitt Romney. As Dick just noted, it was Gingrich who brought up a lot of the attacks on Romney's record at Bain Capital in the past several decades. So I doubt there's a lot of love there. I think what we see in both these cases with Gingrich and Bill Clinton are kind of egomaniacs, people who like being in the spotlight, who probably miss being at the center of political attention, and they probably were not very reluctant to get involved in the campaign. And just like there's sort of a fraught relationship between Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich, Barack Obama and Bill Clinton have had their own ups and downs, obviously stemming from the 2008 primaries with Hillary Clinton, and they've sort of mended fences. They're pretty good together in public, but there's not a sense that they're always on the same team with each other. So I think it is more of a symbolic show of unity on the Democratic side.
Well, David, speaking about Newt Gingrich, he apparently is not going to speak at the Republican convention, but he's going to run some workshops, and apparently they've already been dubbed Newt University.
it's sort of a creative way of finding a use of Newt Gingrich that doesn't put him front and center. And that's probably a situation, a role that Newt Gingrich is favorable toward. He likes to lecture. He likes to feel like the smartest guy in the room. And I think this is probably a good use of his time. How many people will show up at these, at the Republican convention? That's an open question.
Well, and speaking of Gingrich and Romney, Sheldon Adelson had been, Dick, a big supporter of Newt Gingrich, had funded a lot of the very critical ads, and now he has switched and is a big supporter of Mitt Romney. Is this just politics and a very wealthy man hedging his bets, so to speak?
Well, sure. And I think he, from Sheldon Adelson, of course, the super rich...
I think it's a billionaire,
I should say, and casino owner, and very hawkish on Israel, obviously. And so, he's putting his money on Romney because he sort of perceives, rightly or wrongly, that Romney is going to be sort of, more hawkish on Israel than Obama. And of course, unfortunately, it's already led to a problem where Adelson followed Romney over to Israel when Romney was over there, and Romney made some remarks about that sort of ticked off the Palestinian
culture
side of the equation there. Yeah, and it was almost like he was playing to Adelson in the room, and I really don't know how much he got out of that. I mean, I just finished a piece that about Jewish voters in America, and a very small percentage of Jewish voters put Israel at the top of their priority list on issues. They're mostly very much traditional liberals on domestic stuff, and that's the stuff that drives most Jewish voters. And so most of the people who are hawkish on Israel and who care about voting Israel as an issue, Jewish voters, are already, those are the Jewish Republicans. So I don't think Adelson's really helped them on that.
Anything you want to weigh in on that, David? And though I do want to get to some callers.
Well, just that with Adelson, I think Israel certainly is a part of the equation in terms of backing Romney, but there may be some other business interests involved, some casino interest. After all, Sheldon Adelson made his money. He became a billionaire, at least in part, through gambling interests. And without wading into too many of the details, that could be part of the equation here, that he simply thinks that Romney is better at protecting those interests.
Mm-hmm. And how do Mormons feel about casinos and gambling? I don't have the answer to that.
Myself.
I don't have a good answer for that offhand. I mean, it's not something that's been put out there directly. It will be interesting to see how much traction that might get going forward. And it's kind of hard to prove. Like any situation where you have a big funder supporting a candidate, it's hard to pin down exact motives why anybody's giving money. But it just the reasons could be numerous for Sheldon Adelson. Although no doubt Israel and the Middle East politics do play a significant role in the situation.
And that's David Mark, editor-in-chief of Politics, with an X at the end of the word, published by Topics. Another X at the end of that word, joining us on Radio Times. He was, until just very recently, senior editor at Politico. Also with us is Dick Pohlman. He's a writer-in-residence at the University of Pennsylvania, has a blog on WHYY's Newsworks, a website called National Interest. He also has a column at the Philadelphia Inquirer called American Debate. And yes, we are talking about politics, the race to the White House, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Kind of a free-for-all, so if you have any questions or comments, do give us a call. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-WHYY. We have James from Westtown joining us on Radio Times. And James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, America.
Good morning.
After many years of my contributing $20 to campaigns, I've always been wondering if I really had any impact on the campaigns. So I thought of a novel approach to the elections that I think people might agree to.
Okay.
And that would be let the lobbyists, the multinationals, and the wealthy nominate and elect the president. And we, as bystanders, watch the going-ons between all these groups to see how it works. Because in the end, it seems like the lobbyists, the multinationals, and the wealthy end up getting their way to run the country and even the world.
And, James, are you saying that that's actually what we have now? Is that the point you're trying to make?
That's what we have now.
Okay.
We have those small contributions, and it makes it seem like we have an impact, yet those millions go into these PAC funds and everything. seem to rule the day.
Okay, no, it's a fair point, and let me give our guests a chance to get a whack at it. And Dick, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a point there, which I think is reflected by the fact that, roughly speaking, half the population doesn't vote, half the voting age population doesn't vote in this country, and I think it's in part because you know, they don't feel like they're going to make a difference, and that people, once they get in office, don't speak for them. And I think it's—I mean, Obama's been kind of whipsawed on both sides. I mean, he was elected with an enormous, enormous share of very small contributions. I mean, he had a record haul in 2008. Small contributions made a huge difference, and but a lot of people, sort of on the left side of the spectrum, think that he's been too beholden to people, to special interests and people in the upper brackets. But the special interests and people in the upper brackets think that he has been that he has not been sufficiently vigilant, sufficiently subservient, I should say. But anyway, the bottom line being, I think that people don't vote because they just feel they can't make a difference. So if that, so I think the speaker was referring to.
Yeah, and David, you're kind of in the thick of this as editor-in-chief of politics, and also at Politico, hosting these discussions. People are frustrated, they're angry, they're worried.
They are, but I just kind of disagree with the premise of the question there, that the average voter doesn't really matter. There's a reason why both these campaigns are spending millions, tens of millions of dollars, even more, for a relatively small select group of voters in swing states, in 9 or 10 states, in Pennsylvania, Colorado, Virginia, Ohio, Florida, et cetera, because that's how you win elections. And it's not that rich people have any more votes. They do contribute a lot more to money, and that's what gets out the advertising and allows candidates to get their voices and their messages out there. But ultimately, rich people only have one vote, just like everybody else on election day. That's why, to me, covering politics is so fun, because on election day, in a sense, if you vote, everybody's equal.
But if I give a candidate $20 and call them up, I'm not sure, David, if they're going to respond to my call. But if I give them, you know, $20,000, don't you think I'm going to get to the front of the line there?
No, that's a fair point. It's part of a broader discussion about campaign finance and other issues. But I'll tell you, the candidates do want these smaller donations. I'm not equating that with a large super PAC donation, a 5-6-figure giving allowance, anything like that. But there's a reason why these candidates and campaigns keep pushing for these small dollars, and why the Obama campaign keeps having raffles for small dollar donors to come meet the president and participate in events, because this money actually does add up at the margins. And it's also worth remembering, even the wealthiest contributors or potential contributors can only give $2,500 at a time, which is more than most people could afford to give in one sitting. But you got to collect a lot of $2,500 donations to really make it count. So actually, I would say at the margins, $20, $30 actually can pitch into the campaign fund.
Go ahead, Dick, and then we'll get Shauna from the Northeast.
Yeah, well, here's the counter argument to the people who say they don't vote and it doesn't make a difference. I was at a small dinner a couple months ago, and one of the people there was the chairman of a think tank in Washington, and he says to me, "I haven't voted since 1964." And I said, "You got to be kidding!" And he said, "No, I'm not kidding. I haven't voted since 1964." And I then said, "Hello, Florida, the year 2000. You don't think your vote makes a difference in the 2000 election, because back in that hanging Chad election, 537 votes officially made the difference." And you look at Obama and Romney on what they want to do on tax policy, for example, and on spending, and there is a marked contrast between the two.
Right.
To me, it's like, you know, you'd want to participate in that because it does make a difference which one of those guys sets the priorities for taxes and spending in the next 4 years.
So it's not a Tweedledum, Tweedledee race. Actual choices here.
I've never thought that.
Let me get, it looks like Shauna from the Northeast to join us on Radio Times. And Shauna, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, question is there a written or unwritten rule that the media cannot call someone a liar? Because they're always saying, like, it's untrue or not factually correct. But when you're talking to someone else and they You just say, why are you lying to me, or why'd you call me a liar? I mean, normal people just, if they're lying, they're lying, but you never hear on the media that they call people a liar.
It's a fair...
So is there a rule that you can't call someone a liar?
Shauna, if I don't give this, your question to Dick Pullman, he's going to, like, jump out of his skin. Go ahead, Dick, and I'm sure, David, you want to take it as well. Yes, go ahead.
No, my column over there.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Okay, sorry, I'm passing columns
okay,
over to...
I think... There's a, you know, in the sort of, in the nomenclature of objective journalism, it's considered too, and I'm not defending, I'm explaining this, it's considered too conclusionary, perhaps, and too subjective, perhaps, to say that somebody is lying. So what you will hear instead in the New York Times the other day when they were talking about Romney's welfare ad, they said the charge is a bit of a stretch. Or they will say that certain facts seem to point the other way or whatever. Those of us who are more in the commentary end of things, such as myself, can pretty much call a spade, as long as you can back it up. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to put out the word lie, which is, you know, it's a loaded word, it's a provocative word, you have to be able to back it up. I mean, my column in the Philadelphia Inquirer this morning begins, lying is endemic to politics, but Mitt Romney may have pioneered a new low this week.
And this is the welfare ad.
About the welfare. Now, it's a very strong thing to say, and I thought very hard about whether I was going to use the word there. But I was comfortable doing it as long as you can back it up.
Shauna, let me see what David Mark has to say. Your thoughts, David?
Yeah, candidates themselves don't generally like to use that word unless they feel that they're really aggrieved. It's going to help them. Good or bad, fair or not, it can make candidates look like whiners if they go talk about being lied about, like they can't take the heat. And I agree with Dick. That's why it's up to those of us in the commentary business, those reporting on campaigns, to bring up that word and then let voters decide on it. But to get directly to her question, there is no law preventing anybody from being called a liar. In fact, in politics and campaigns, there are a lot fewer laws that come into play here. If you're trying to sell breakfast cereal or laundry detergent or some other commercial product, you actually have to be really careful what you say about the opposition, because the Federal Trade Commission, other regulatory bodies can come down on you. In politics, almost anything goes. Occasionally, there are libel or slander suits, but those usually don't go anywhere, and the burden is on the free speech and allowing people to make their charges. So there's really no prohibition on calling somebody a liar.
Well, I think if you watch cable television or you read blogs, including Dick Pullman's blogs, there's a lot of back and forth and accusations and charges and calls of lying and liars.
I was going to say some of the players, not necessarily the candidates, but some of the surrogates to the candidates are throwing that word around. It seems to me like they're throwing it around to me more than they used to in the past. I mean, just last weekend, after Harry Reid made the allegation, baseless as far as we know, that Romney had not paid income taxes for 10 years, the Republican national chairman, Reince Priebus, was on one of the Sunday shows last weekend and called Reid a quote-unquote dirty liar.
Right.
And in my experience, I don't seem to remember hearing that kind of talk very often.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about politics, the race for the White House, the campaign, the candidates, the surrogates, the press. Dick Pullman writes a blog here at WHYY called National Interest. You can read it on the WHYY Newsworks website. Also with us, David Mark, editor-in-chief of Politics, published by Topics, and joining us from California, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Announcing the 2012 WHYY Connections Festival, September 6th through 9th. 4 days of free arts and culture events, including an outdoor concert featuring Yola Tango, Frank Turner, Maps and Atlases, and more, Saturday, September 8th. And on September 9th, performances by Fred Parris and the Five Satins, Charlie Gracie, and more at the Philadelphia Doo-Wop Festival. More artists and events to come. Visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Should there be more investigations of Wall Street banks? We'll talk to a man who was the jury foreman in a banking case and wrote a note to the judge saying the SEC needed to crack down. Also, is Michael Phelps the top Olympian ever? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking politics with David Mark and Dick Pullman, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me read an email that we got. And David, I'll toss this to you. This is from William. He says, is there a reason why Mitt is probably not going to win Massachusetts? Don't candidates generally win in their home state based on the polls? He won't win Michigan or Massachusetts. Why don't the Democrats use this more to their advantage to point out how ineffective he is at winning his home state? What do you think about that, David?
It's worth remembering 40 years ago, George McGovern won only Massachusetts when he lost all the other states to Richard Nixon. So Massachusetts has a long history of going Democratic, and Mitt Romney probably could not even have been reelected as governor of Massachusetts had he run again in 2006. It was sort of an anomaly that he was elected there. There was a time when Massachusetts was electing Republican state officials, but that's mostly fallen off with a couple exceptions. So I think it's just generally seen as a pretty blue state. Michigan's a more interesting example. That's a state that Mitt Romney, of course, has ties to with his father, having been governor there, having grown up there. And it's a state, actually, if he's going to put together an electoral college majority, he almost needs to win. He's got to pick off not just some states he lost to President Obama in 2008, but some that have been going Democratic for many years, like Michigan. And if he can't get that, or Pennsylvania or something of that nature, he's going to have trouble winning. So I think that actually is a big problem for Mitt Romney.
But, Dick, I wonder whether Governor Mitt Romney is just a different candidate than, or even governor than candidate Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's been running... he's been running away from his record as governor, and most conspicuously, of course, in terms of health care reform, Romney Care, as we now call it, which is, you know, it's ironic. He had, as David just pointed out, actually, when he was stepping down after his first and only term as governor, his in-state polling approval rating was very bad. Mm. And yet now, when you look at in Massachusetts, when they ask people in Massachusetts, what do you think of Romney Care, they like it. You know, he's got like a landslide majority approval for it. But he doesn't want to really talk about that. And it was a really interesting thing came up, by the way, the other day when one of his spokespeople, Andrea Saul, made some offhand remark. It was about a different issue, but she made an offhand remark about Romney Care in Massachusetts. I was about the guy, the family in the Bain ad, in the Super PAC ad, the Obama
that we
Super
played
PAC
at the
ad.
Top of the hour. Yes.
Yeah, right. So that family, you know, they had problems. She died of cancer and stuff. So the spokesman said, "Well, if that family had been in Massachusetts, they would have been covered." And what was interesting was the reaction on the right from that. Rush Limbaugh went ballistic. Ann Coulter went ballistic and said that, you know, why should we be, unless we fire that moron, referring to the spokeswoman. Moron was a quote, yes. Why should we support Romney? And so, you know, he has very little wiggle room to talk about his own record in Massachusetts, which I find not to his advantage.
Let me get to Lisa from Bryn Mawr to join our conversation. And Lisa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a question. I'm wondering why, you know, I watched Barack Obama for almost 4 years. He, for the first 2 years, had such an olive branch reaching out to the Republicans on every issue to the point of frustration for people who voted for him. And yet, all I hear from every analyst, I don't care what station they're on or what publication, they talk about how much the Republicans hate Barack Obama, that they will come out to vote for Romney no matter who he chooses or what he says because of their hatred for him. And that's the word they use, but they never say why. And I want to know what the reason is.
Well, Lisa, let's see if we can find an answer for you. David Mark, do you can you answer Lisa's question?
How much time do we have?
Yeah, exactly. I'm giving you about a minute and a half.
Right,
go ahead.
Right. I'm not sure the quote, hatred of President Obama by those on the right and others is that much more intense than many on the left felt for George W. Bush. There are some unfortunate elements, no doubt, with President Obama. You have the first African-American president. Other things about his background that I think have seeped in. But in a lot of cases, I kind of give the benefit of the doubt to a lot of those who really dislike his policies. There, as Dick noted, there are substantial policy differences on taxing, spending, foreign policy, et cetera, that's just part of the political debate. And the question about the intensity, yes, a lot of people probably hate President Obama and want to come out and vote for Mitt Romney. The question is how much further they're willing to go than that. Are they going to go to phone banks? Are they going to knock on doors, send email, do other volunteer work to elect Mitt Romney? Or are they just kind of going to hold their nose, vote for him, and then not think about it again? And that can be a crucial difference in winning and losing an election.
Dick, do you think it's more visceral than that, what Lisa was describing?
Well, you know, I think all the stuff that went around about how he supposedly wasn't born in America and how supposedly he was a Muslim, and I think that comes from the fact, I'll say this charitably, that his profile is not that of the traditional American president. And I think you know, it's one of those things that's difficult to talk about, and I think that feeds into the emotion about him. I think perhaps going at health care is a very personal issue to a lot of people, and I think health care reform was a real touchstone for a lot of people, and galvanized that feeling that that he was reaching into people's lives in some kind of dictatorial way. I think all that plays into it. But you know, there was another piece of what the caller was saying, how you know, how he had an olive branch out for the first 2 years, and actually he has become much more combative the last 2 years, much more competitively combative and much more outspoken against his opposition, because I think he kind of realized belatedly that extending an olive branch to these people wasn't going to get him anywhere. I mean, I think I wrote once that he puts out his hand and they swallow the hand and then try to, like, bite it all the way up to his shoulder blade. And so he has finally gotten past that, out of necessity. I'm sure it's not the way he would have wanted to have played it. I mean, I think he really genuinely thought, perhaps naively, that he could have been sort of an above the fray non-partisan president. But that's just not the way he's perceived by roughly half the population.
Lisa, thanks for the call to Radio Times. There is actually a new ad out the Romney campaign has put out, and it's called Be Not Afraid. And I'll just summarize it, just a line from it, where Mitt Romney, the ad says, President Obama used his health care plan to declare war on religion, forcing religious institutions to go against their faith. Mitt Romney believes that's wrong. It's really about contraception and the availability of contraception through the Affordable Care Act. And I wonder, David Mark, whether this is risky, because we know, for instance, from Catholics that most female Catholics, women Catholics, either use birth control or support that idea. The president seems to have staked this issue out. Sandra Fluke was presenting the president in Colorado this week. Is contraception a key issue, do you think, in this race for the White House?
I actually think this is kind of a winning issue for President Obama, and I understand the Romney campaign and supporters are trying to frame this as one of religious liberty, which there may be some merit to that. But as you just said, the majority of the populace, particularly even Catholics, many others, basically support the right to contraception, and they're not, I don't think a lot of people are that concerned about it being forced on various hospitals and whatnot. So I just think the Obama side made a cold political calculation that they can win on this, and it's worth taking some heat and umbrage over religious liberty issues. That plays to a relatively narrow slice of the electorate, and those people probably are not likely to vote for President Obama anyway. So I just think the Obama team decided, let's go with this. We're going to get more votes than we'll lose.
What do you think, Dick?
Well, I have two reactions to that. One is I can't help but think, you know, why are we relitigating something that was basically settled 50 years ago? Contraception and birth control. But I think the ad, as Marty, as you've just described it, strikes me as an example of as evidence that Romney is still trying at this late date, this close to the convention, to nail down the conservative base. As David said, these are the people who are not going to vote for Obama anyway, but Romney still feels the need to sort of to put this message out there to remind them, oh, I'm still with you on this. I mean, he shouldn't have to be running an ad like this late in the game. He should have had this stuff nailed down. He should have had the base nailed down at this point. And this is clear to me that he hasn't.
Oh, interesting. Let me get, looks like Matt from Drexel Hill to join our conversation. Matt, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. The last caller had proposed a question about why there's so much hatred for Barack Obama, and I'm a Caucasian male, and I'm just going to come right out and say, you know, there's a lot of racism in this country towards him. And I see it and I hear it. All you got to do is look at some of the things that you get in your email or that you see that people post, and that's a big part of the problem there. And I also wanted to state the fact that I think that there's a lot of correlations between him and Jimmy Carter. You know, he doesn't seem like he wants to play ball with a lot of the politicians that are in charge. He's trying to do things that may actually be right and moral, and he's being torn down for it because he won't play ball with a lot of these guys. And I think Jimmy Carter experienced the same thing, and the economy. He's got a lot of things working against him. So that was my comment.
Appreciate the call to Radio Times. We could spend a whole hour on this. Were you saying that, Dick, in a more obscure way?
Oh, about the race factor.
Yes.
I was saying it in a more obscure way, although as I wrote in the Inquirer today, this welfare ad that Romney had, where he's basically saying, oh, all Obama wants to do is mail you your welfare check. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you can just basically see the sleight of hand there. It's like Obama's black. Welfare recipients, at least in the stereotype, most welfare recipients are in fact white, but the stereotype is that they're black and that they're sitting around collecting welfare checks. And so when he puts out a thing in the ad saying Obama wants to mail you your welfare check, to me that like brings back some of the racial coding that the Republicans used to traffic in 20, 30 years ago.
We could go on with this, but let me put something else on the table. David, we've got the conventions coming up, first the Republican and then the Democratic one, both in the South. I know it gets very hot in the South in August and early September. Do conventions matter anymore, or is there a reason to have a convention?
Technically, there is a reason that you have to formally nominate the candidate, ratify their choice as vice president, and there are also some technical aspects about campaign finance, when you can use certain parts of campaign funds that were raised in the general election versus the primary. But those are all essentially technical bookkeeping matters that could be taken care of in an hour or two at a convention. I think they, in large part, have outlived their usefulness, and I think they're both sides are starting to recognize that. The fact that the Democratic convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, is going to be 3 days rather than 4 days is testament to the fact that both sides, I think, kind of want to limit this, maybe pull this down. Republicans are perhaps playing it up more this time around because they're the opposition party and they need to feature their candidates. But I think going forward, both sides may try and ratchet down the conventions and spend their time and money in other ways that are more effective.
What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I agree with David. I think actually the Republican convention in 2008, correct me if I'm wrong, because for weather reasons, I think there was some giant storm. They had to take it down, I believe, to 3 days. And, you know, and they realized, okay, well, they got it out in 3 days. Look, there's less network coverage.
Right.
You know, they used to be, when I was a kid, there used to be this gavel-to-gavel coverage for hours and hours and hours. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it's like 1 hour a night of live network coverage. And I think it's sort of like saying, well, even the TV players know that it's just a big TV show, and that people are going to be getting their information any number of ways. I think the only thing that people are ever really going to remember, if they even remember these at all, are going to be the acceptance speeches, you know, from Romney, Obama, and Biden, and whoever the pick is for Veep.
I remember when the Republican convention was in Philadelphia in 2000.
Right.
I have never seen such beautiful portable toilets in my life.
Well, they did that, and they also cleaned up the Admiral Wilson Boulevard in New Jersey for their delegates. So that was a very good benefit.
Eye-opening. let me get Dan from Cape May to join our conversation. And Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Earlier, there was a comment about how in October the debates would make a big difference, and everything in this world is getting shorter and shorter as far as timelines are concerned. My question has to do with the fact that why is it a 2-year process? I mean, it seems to me that there has been so much waste of time, the president's time, in trying to work this political process, as well as everyone else's time, the media's time, et cetera, for what essentially is a two-year process. And when you talk about apathy about the vote, it's because we've been listening to this stuff for 2 years. Why can't it be 3 or 4 months?
Well,
that's my question. Thank you.
Well, I hear your pain, and we're almost out of time here, but David, let me just give you a chance to respond. And you two are kind of in the thick of it for those 2 years.
Right. Journalists might have a slightly different perspective. It's kind of a full employment act for a lot of political journalists out there to keep the campaign going. But I do take the caller's point. Much of it is repetitive, and you just hear the same speeches over and over again. I'm not quite sure what could be done about it, because particularly with the primary process, each state, Iowa, New Hampshire, the other early states, don't want to give any advantage to the other. They're not going to cede anything. So unless there was some kind of unilateral disarmament in which everybody came to an agreement on a schedule that would push it back, that might improve things. But otherwise, I feel the caller's pain as well, but I'm just not sure what could really be done about it.
Well, Dick, in 30 seconds or less, we haven't talked about who Mitt Romney might pick for vice president. Mm-hmm. Is this a big question mark, news story?
Vice presidents don't always necessarily make a difference, but you know, it is the story of the moment.
Yes.
I guess the rule of thumb would be if he wants to be cautious, he's going to pick somebody like Rob Portman or Tim Pawlenty, what they now known in the press as the boring white guys. And if he wants to, because he's behind in the polls, if he wants to take a bolder shot at things, he might go for someone like Paul Ryan, who's getting a big boost in the last 24 hours from the conservative commentariat, and supposedly that's what we'll be hearing about a lot the next couple of weeks.
Well, on that note, Dick Pullman, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And you can read his blog at WHYY's Newsworks website, and it's the blog is called National Interest. David Mark, congratulations on your new job. Thank you for getting up early and joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's editor-in-chief of Politics, that's Politix, published by Topics, that's Topix. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for those phone calls as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.